I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Everybody has that one important year in their life where they grow up or they come to some realization as to where life's headed, a year where something changes. For my guest now, Beth Kaplan, 1979 was one such year. She writes about this time in her life in a new book, Loose Woman, My Odyssey from Lost to Found. It's the late 1970s, and the world around her is changing, but she is too, whether she knows it or not. She's in Vancouver, a successful young actress who's gotten good notices for her work with various theater companies in town. Performing has been somewhat natural to her, even as a kid, and she's doing well. She portrays the scene here in town with all its sex and drugs. That's at once familiar, as it seems like it'll change soon enough, as it does with a new decade. Beth is looking for a relationship. Despite forging connections and encounters, she's looking for something lasting. She ends up in Europe and at L'Arche in France, the community founded by Jean Vanier that takes in and houses the intellectually disabled. Beth works there that year, and the life-changing experience there unlocks something about her she hadn't known. She also contends with her parents in this year, and their relationship reaches a new level. But as she understands her mother and father, two rather unique and remarkable people, a little bit better. It's a compelling book, one that's fascinating with all its cameos. Dan Aykroyd was a pal at Carleton University, and Michael J. Fox was a castmate at the Arts Club here in Vancouver. She also deals with the recent revelations about Vanier and L'Arche. Beth Kaplan left a career as an actress to earn an MFA in creative writing. She has taught memoir and personal essay writing since 1994. She has written three other books, including Jewish Shakespeare, a biography of her late great-grandfather. Visit bethkaplan.ca for more. This new memoir is published by Iguana Books. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Beth Kaplan. Ms. Kaplan, good morning.
Good morning. How are you, Joseph? Good to hear from you.
I'm very good, and I hope you're well as well.
Yes, yes, I'm great. Thank you.
Let's begin with the title, because I think people will who are listening to this have, for the most part, haven't read the book yet. Why the title Loose Woman?
Yeah, that was controversial, and several early readers told me that I shouldn't use that title. Because it was a misnomer, because it would give the impression that this was kind of perhaps a bit of a sleazy novel. You know, there is a sexual connotation to Loose Woman. But I really was meaning loose in terms of openness, generosity, really being open to the world. You know, it was a time in which my life was shifting completely, and luckily I landed in a situation that opened me right up. And so I did feel loose. I was disconnected from my past, from who I had been, and I was open to a whole new future. So it's another interpretation of loose, though there is a section of the book that definitely is about a loose woman period of my life a long time ago in the 70s when, as young feminists, we felt that we needed to sleep with men the way men slept with women, kind of carelessly. So that is also, there is that loose woman connotation.
Yeah, I took it to mean as I was reading the book that you were at loose ends, if you will, that you, you're a young woman who is trying to figure out where life is and where it's going to take you, say.
Exactly. Yes, that's exactly right. So at loose ends is a very good way to put it. Yeah. I was in a profession that had rewarded me, that had encouraged me from the very beginning. And so it seemed that I was born to do this job as an actress, and yet something in me kept saying, this isn't right. You shouldn't be doing this. And it was a very confusing, almost tormenting time of my life.
The book begins, I guess, with you living here in Vancouver.
Yes.
The times you write about are a different era, obviously. Yet it's for me living in Vancouver. I haven't lived anywhere else. It's recognizable in a way. What is it like to look back? Does it feel like 40 years?
It feels like another lifetime, certainly, looking back 40 years. It is hard to believe. It sounds like such a long time, and yet, of course, it's just a snap of the fingers. And I come back to Vancouver as often as possible. I consider it my second home, mm-hmm. and many of my dearest friends still live there or now on the islands. A lot of people have moved to the islands. So it's with the greatest joy that I come back to what I consider the most beautiful city in the world. But it certainly was a different Vancouver. It was much rougher. It was much bleaker in those days. The downtown where I worked really was shady and almost dangerous. And so it's, you know, seeing this chic, polished, expensive Vancouver, it's a different place. But at the same time, it's the same place. It still has that magnificent vista of beaches and mountains. And, you know, it's just an extraordinarily beautiful place. I love coming back.
Yeah, the art scene in Vancouver then is fascinating to look at because the theater, you had, you know, more than, I guess, two companies at the time doing live theater. And then you had the CBC doing radio and television drama even.
Yes.
It seems like an easier place to make a living, was it?
Oh, absolutely. I feel very lucky. I graduated from theater school in London and came to Toronto, which I found really intimidating. It was very hard to get work without an agent, and it was hard to get an agent. And, you know, I was doing little sort of plays at midnight in the local theaters. And by chance, I was working, my day job was for the Canadian Conference of the Arts, and I heard about a program teaching improv in Victoria. Mm. And I managed to get a Canada Council grant to come to do this brief workshop, which turned into a job with the Victoria company. And at that point, I had a choice of going back to Toronto or going to Vancouver. And I just took a leap of faith and moved to Vancouver. I didn't know anybody. And within, I think, 2 or 3 weeks, I was hired for a show, which, you know, happened to be with Kim Cattrall, who has gone on to great things. And I was lucky enough to meet people at the Arts Club, where immediately I was part of the family. And so I ended up working almost nonstop once I arrived in Vancouver. I just went from job to job. And there, you know, there was City Stage and there were West Coast Actors. There were lots and lots of companies, Playhouse, and of course the Arts Club, mm-hmm. which only had one theater at that point. But it was a wonderful space, this small space above the bar on Seymour Street. Mm-hmm. So it was a very rich, very interesting time. All of the theater community came to that bar. And so even though there were people who worked more often at the Playhouse or people who worked more often at Tamanus, you know, a sort of alternative theater company at the Culch, mm-hmm. Everybody gathered. And so we all knew each other. It really was a big family. It was a wonderfully rich time to be in Vancouver.
And you write, I forget the name, what you refer to the apartment. I guess it's Kingsway and Broadway, is that right, where you lived?
Yes, sort of Main and Broadway.
Yeah, where they it's a triangle there, yeah. It's a big, I don't know if you've seen it lately, I pass it every day going to work, and it's, I think, a 20-story building now.
No, well, the last time I was there, the house was still there.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the house is still there. It's near Quebec Street
on
Manitoba Street.
Oh, okay.
And it's on East Broadway, and so it was an old house with there was two apartments on the main floor, two apartments on the second floor, and then there was an attic. There was this very steep staircase up to the attic, which was my home, a tiny apartment, but with a view. If you bent low, yeah. I had a view right over the downtown to the mountains. So it was really a wonderful, tiny little cozy space for me.
I was thinking of, I guess, where the hot jazz cellar was.
Yeah, the Hot Jazz Club.
On,
it was
on
right
Watson?
Next door. Yeah, it was the Hot Jazz Club.
Oh,
right
I see.
Next
okay.
door.
I keep thinking of that where it's Main, Watson, and then Kingsway, where that corner
yes,
is. Yeah.
I think this is a little further
east. Yeah, that's the book that there's a recent book about the jazz cellar, I guess.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Yes. When eventually I got married after the span of this book, we had a big party at the home of a friend in, you know, out by UBC, and we hired the band from the Hot Jazz Club
to
come and play
because
that music, you know, also we had ended up going to New Orleans, and that was our music. So hot jazz means a great deal to me.
Yeah. Some of the people you meet early on here in Vancouver, Janet Wright, Michael J. Fox, was it Janet Wright who said that Fox was too short to make it in Hollywood?
Yes, that was a wonderful memory. So we were doing a play called The Shadow Box, and that was also with Alan Gray and Goldie Semple. It was an extraordinary cast. And Michael J. Fox, who was we called Mikey at that point, he was 18. You know, he was this lovely young kid from Burnaby who was very ambitious and very professional at that age, playing Janet's young son. He was playing a kid of about 13, and, you know, he was very, very good.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he told us that he wanted to go to Hollywood, and Janet more or less sort of leaned over and ruffled his hair, and she said, you know, Mikey, you're really talented, but you're just way too short. And so luckily he didn't listen to her, and you know, the rest is history. We've watched his marvelous career.
She also told you, I guess, you know, you're figuring out your love life, if you will, and you know, the relationship that you know that you're seeking, I guess. She gives you advice in terms of how to find a man, I guess, doesn't she?
Yes. She told me to not care if I found a man or not. If I pretended not to care, men would be more attracted to me, and you know, and as I write in the book, I cared far too much to pretend not to care. Janet, I did a number of shows with Janet, and of course she was an extraordinary talent, as was her sister Susan, who was also working in Vancouver at the time. You know, Janet was very tough, and she could be very difficult, and she could be very harsh. Because she knew exactly what she wanted, and she sort of ended up directing a lot of the shows that she was in, even if she wasn't the director, you know.
Yeah.
I was in a tour called Cruel Tears, which went right across the country with Janet and with Winston Record, and again with an extraordinary cast. So I got to know Janet very, very well, and I have enormous respect and admiration for her.
Yeah. I'm not an actor, but I enjoyed reading the book when you talk about acting and what it was like for you as an adult, but also as a young person. I mean, you started out as a child. Radio and television, I guess, was before theater, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it was just something that happened. Well, I grew up in Halifax, and so we were trying out different, you know, after-school activities for me, and I definitely wasn't very good at ballet, and I ended up quitting the piano, which I, of course, regret, as my mother told me I would, and then they found this drama class, and I started to go to a drama class in Mrs. Stanbury's basement, and we just improvised fairy stories, and before long, she had us on the radio in Halifax, and then we were on TV, and so really within the year that I started with her, just this little group in her basement, we had a weekly show on television, again, improvising fairy stories. So it was a very early introduction to showbiz for me. And from there, the various theater companies in Halifax, if they needed a child actor, they would phone Mrs. Stanbury. So I ended up in two plays as well by the age of 11. And so that's what I mean when I said it seemed that I was chosen for this profession, that it really chose me very early, even though from a very early age I loved doing it, but I also loved writing, and I had sort of thought I would like to be an actor or a writer. So the acting definitely came first.
And it seems like the acting came easy because, well, people were rushing about just before curtain, nervous. You didn't find you were nervous, did you?
I wasn't nervous until later. When I am in that first big show, I mean, I had a big part. Mm-hmm. I was 10, I think. And no, it was an interesting experience, and I enjoyed it very much, and I wasn't nervous at all. And then the nerves came later, and I think they talk about how when you turn 12 or 13 and suddenly you're aware of yourself in the world in a new way and you begin to shut down, and that's when I discovered nerves. But those first plays, I was not nervous at all. No, it was just a really wonderful experience.
And then earlier on, you were recognized on the bus for after your television appearances. And you loved that, didn't you?
Yes, I did. You know, as I said in the book, I felt like Gina Lollobrigida. You know, that somebody came up to me and said, "You're in that show, aren't you?" And of course, that's something. In fact, later when I was thinking of giving up the theater, I thought that's something that I would miss a great deal, that of being recognized, of people coming up to you on the street and saying, "I saw you in such and such," you know. And that is something, yes, that's very special for anyone who's in the public eye, I guess.
You had that even in Greece, right? Someone recognized you from the stage.
That was incredible, because I was on a ferry, you know, from Crete, and someone came up to me and recognized me from The Club, which was a play in which set in a men's club, and the cast were all in mustaches and tuxedos, but they were all women disguised as men. And so the fact that someone recognized me, not just on a ferry in Greece, but that, you know, she recognized me without my mustache, it was very special. It made me feel great.
You write about your parents, and they just seem like interesting, fascinating people. They're the sort of parents that you describe that people around you who would see you, even early on, they were parents that other people thought were cool. And in this year that you write about in the book, your relationship does evolve, doesn't it? Each of you, I guess, come to a certain understanding, a different understanding of one another, don't you?
Well, I certainly began to there. I mean, my parents come up a lot because they were extraordinary people, both of them. They were both physically, you know, my mother was beautiful, my father was handsome. He was a very public figure. You know, he was I mentioned David Suzuki briefly, but he was a very good friend of David's. And when Dad died, David published a beautiful article about him in The Globe, because they were both popularizers of science, but also working for peace and working for the advancement of science. And my father was very heavily involved in fighting against the Vietnam War and against nuclear war. And he was also very involved with scientific organizations. He became president of various huge international biochemical conferences. So he was very visible, charming, larger than life. And my mother was this, you know, was a great beauty who was also very musical, as was my father. But they were difficult parents, and that's the reality that at some point I'm going to explore in greater depth, is that on the surface they were incredibly cool, and they were wonderful parents in many ways. They were also terrible parents in many ways, and I think that's clear in the book. I mean, when my mother is telling me, you know, secrets about her affairs and her sex life, and, you know, things, boundaries that simply didn't exist. And that my father and I had many years of a very difficult relationship. But by the time of the book, it is very much healed. and the great love and friendship between us is very clear at that point. But it was a progression. I was really beginning at the end of my 20s to understand who I was in relation to them. It did take a few more years.
Yeah. I feel bad for people who, say, give up on the relationship between parents earlier than their 20s, you know what I mean, or their late 20s.
Yes. Though sometimes it is necessary. Mm. But here, it has been really a lifelong journey for me. I mean, just because I've started to begin work on a book about them, I managed to get in touch with a woman. You know, I mention in the book that my mother thinks that my father had an affair with a student and had a baby with her. I mean, that she got pregnant and had a baby that she gave up for adoption, and my mother thought the baby was my father's, and she kind of gave me this information, and, you know, what am I supposed to do with that? So only last week, I got in touch, I managed to find the woman, who is now in her 70s, who was Dad's student, and she still lives in Amsterdam, and we began to correspond, and finally I asked her. You know, what her relationship had been with Dad. And she said, I thought you might ask. And she said there was a great love between us, and he was like a father to me, and he meant the world to me, but there was never anything untoward. And she said, I know your mother had these suspicions, you know, but that never happened. And so after all these years, I finally find out that I don't have a half-sibling somewhere in the world. It's a kind of complicated relationship that I think many people do not have with their parents.
Yeah. So she still lives in Amsterdam, and when you first get over there, your father suggests you stay with her. And there's a moment in the book where your mother says, well, you're there trying to find clues, I guess, in the apartment.
Yes.
But there's a beautiful moment in the book where once you get to Amsterdam, I guess you go to a museum and you see a Vermeer.
Yes.
It's such a moving moment in terms of describing what art means to someone, especially that moment. For people listening to us, because I think it's one of the more beautiful moments in the book, just what you're feeling when you see that painting.
Yes, it was an extraordinary moment, an unforgettable moment. You know, just to backtrack a minute, people have asked me how I remember so much, you know, in writing the details in the book. And, of course, I've had a diary all my life, and so I had to go to the diary for some of the details. But some things were absolutely powerfully clear in my mind, unforgettable. And that moment was one of them that just, you know, I'd heard I was 28 and on this great adventure. So I heard that the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam was a must-see, and I went. And so I'm looking at the Rembrandts, and they're very nice and big and impressive. And then I turn the corner, and there's Vermeer. You know, there's just three very small Vermeers. There were four. So I'm looking at this one. There's a beautiful, you know, the famous woman with the jug. And then there's another one, the woman with the letter. And there's another. And then there was the view of Delft. And I'm looking at this beautiful, beautiful painting of brick and lives, of these tiny lives. I mean, even as I'm telling you about it, I could start to cry. Suddenly it was an epiphany about the beauty of art. And here was this man 400 years ago who had painted what he saw and what he felt. And here was I, you know, weeping, standing in front of this. It hit me like a lightning bolt. It was so powerful. So, and that has happened to me a few times in art, and I think it happens to everyone, where suddenly you're looking at a painting, you're reading a book, you're listening to a piece of music, and it stabs you in the heart. And that's, you know, that's why we have art. It moves us, it brings us to another place, it clears our eyes to see the world in a new way. I felt this huge gift had been given to me. And ever since then, of course, Vermeer is my absolute favorite, and I will go out of my way at any time to see a Vermeer.
Yeah, it was such a powerful moment as I was reading the book. And it reminds us of the necessity of art, especially now, just how important it is. And I suppose, you know, the theater as well.
Yes.
Just how yes, it impacts one's life, right?
Yes. I was thinking, of course, when I was away, a lot about the theater and what it meant. You know, was it simply frivolous kind of escapism? Was there something more important that I wanted to do with my life? And, of course, theater at its best does the same thing. You know, it's we go and we're sitting in the dark watching people live their lives in front of us, watching people make decisions, watching people change, watching terrible and beautiful things happen to human beings right in front of us. That's the magic of theater that you can't capture on a screen, you know, particularly on a phone screen or a computer screen, mm-hmm. the way we watch now, that you're watching a human life in front of you be played out. And of course, if it's a good play and if it's well done, we see ourselves there. We are putting ourselves in the place of the protagonists, and we are understanding something different about them and about ourselves at the same time. So art is about opening, you know, making us loose, making us open to the world in a different way.
A good portion of the book is where you talk about your time at L'Arche in France. You write at the end of the book, I guess as a postscript, about these recent headlines that have emerged about Jean Vanier.
Yes.
In your time there, you in the book, you write about this undercurrent of sexuality. That has nothing to do with what we've subsequently learned about Vanier and other people, right?
Yes. No, not at all. Except in a certain way it does. So, you know, that Vanier created this magnificent institution of L'Arche, which is now all over the world, and which does incomparable good. There's no question that the L'Arche communities, you know, the hundreds of L'Arche communities, have provided a home and shelter and understanding and comfort to many, many people with disabilities. And the people who work there as well, which is, you know, what the book is about, what it did for me working there. But there was, at that point in the 70s, there was a lack of dealing with sexuality that I think came from the top and partially was, of course, part of the Catholic Church at that time, that people, we didn't talk really much about the sexuality of handicapped people. And, of course, it was a huge issue. You know, that people with disabilities have sexual feelings and sexual needs the same as anybody else. And it was simply shoved under a carpet. And I remember asking about Jean, asking someone at the community, you know, is Jean not a priest? Mm-hmm. Does he have a sex life? Is he gay? You know, we'd never heard about a partner, and people just said, he's a saintly man. You know, that's not part of the story. Nobody knew, you know, and then these the truth of the fact that he had sexually assaulted at least six women. It wasn't that he assaulted them. He coerced them into sexual activity with him in the guise of kind of spiritual comfort and, you know, spiritual enlightenment. Really, really despicable and absolutely devastating to anybody who has had anything to do with L'Arche and to Canadians generally. You know, there's schools named for the man. He was going to be, there was talk of him being beatified by the church.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something that we all in our little community had to deal with. And, you know, the fact that there's the scene where I'm sleeping in a tent with two men with disabilities, and somehow it probably shouldn't have happened that way, you know, but it never occurred to us to think about the sexual implications of what we were doing. Now, of course, it's very, very different. and you know, assistants are very careful.
Right. What did your time at L'Arche, what did that reveal about yourself? And I guess it clarified a lot of things in your mind, didn't it, about where you were headed, say?
Well, that was what was such a surprise to me. I just thought that I was going to, you know, that it would be a sort of placeholder in my life.
Right.
That because I had a job in November, but nothing until then, that I would just spend the summer doing this interesting thing, which would give me a chance to stay longer in France. And of course, I was curious because these good friends of mine had spent their lives at L'Arche, you know, Gail and Alain, as I called them in the book. Mm-hmm. And so so I was curious, but I just thought it would be an interesting experience, and then I go home. And yes, it was profoundly affecting because I came from a world in which something was expected all the time. I felt that I needed to be sparkling and funny and interesting, and of course I needed to have good reviews, and I needed to be pretty, and you know, that sort of entering a room, something was expected, and I needed to deliver, I needed to be funny and to, you know, to charm and to make myself interesting. This was all, of course, about getting a job and keeping the job and, you know, being the kind of person that theaters wanted to employ and maybe that men wanted to date. And suddenly I'm in a place where all that matters is making sure that Jean-Claude gets his clothes on and, you know, that another of the men doesn't hurt himself, you know, getting out of the minivan. Mm-hmm. And we needed to keep food on the table and we needed to clean the floor. And what was needed from me was patience and compassion and attention. And that's it. And that wasn't easy for me. It wasn't easy for me to suddenly not be the sparkly person that I, you know, that I felt was always needed. What was needed was paying attention and being there. Mm. And learning to settle into myself, to shut up and listen, and to learn to love people who, when I first met them, had really terrified me. These were men who were physically and mentally and disabled, and in some ways, when I first saw them, they frightened me. I found them grotesque, you know. And of course, after a week, let alone after 4.5 months, mm-hmm. they were my family. They became family, and it was my job to take care of them, and they took care of me, too. So it was a profoundly moving and healing experience. And I returned with a different sense of myself. Yes, I did come back feeling a depth in me that I hadn't known was there, a depth and a sense of compassion and of trust in myself that helped me to change my life.
You literally go into the 1980s a different person, don't you?
That is exactly how I felt, that I entered the 1980s. It was literally because it was at that New Year's Eve party, which was this wonderful experience of being with my fellow actors on the set of The Three Sisters at the Waterfront Theater. And we were celebrating New Year's Eve 1980 together. And I withdrew to say the prayer, the Lord's Prayer that I had learned in French at L'Arche. And that was the different me. That was the me able to pull back from the excitement and the, you know, the, whatever was going on and settle into my deeper self.
What I found fascinating as I was reading the book is that you're very honest and you reveal a great deal. Is there much that you held back, say?
In this book, probably not. Well, to tell you the truth, I mean, first of all, of course, the job of a memoirist is to tell the truth. And if you're not risking something, if there isn't something at stake for you as a writer, then why write it and why would people read it? So there is always that challenge to tell the truth. But, you know, to be honest, early readers of the book told me that there were too many men in the early drafts, uh-huh. and I had to take some of them out. You know, there were more men. So, but people said, you know, we get the idea. We don't need to hear about all of them. You know, we know that this was a period in your life in which you were, you know, you were open sexually. And so we get a little bored. And so I took them out. So there are things like that where technically you go, okay, people don't need to know all this. You know, they, one or two gives the idea. So, but yes, I needed to tell the truth about my own confusions, about unpleasant things that happened to me. And, you know, that's, of course, that's why people read memoir. They need to see all the shades of colors.
The other thing I was wondering about as I was finishing the book was in terms of regrets. I mean, you know, who doesn't have a regret or two in their life? It's a terrible feeling, obviously, and when one tries to, I guess, conduct their life so that in the future they don't have regrets. But when you do look back at this period in your life, are there many regrets, or are there things that you know now that you knew that you wish you knew then, say?
I do regret that I was such an insecure person as an actress, and because I do love the theater, and I do feel that as another person, if I'd had more confidence, I think I could have gone further. And also, I regret, for example, that I never worked with a company like Tammanus, which was doing with a sort of alternative theater. I might have explored different kinds of theater. And of course, I have a lot of regrets about personal relationships or about, you know, things I wish I'd done or things I wish I hadn't done. But mostly, I have to say that all of those things, all of those decisions and mistakes led me to this moment where I am now. And you know, it's good here. I'm so grateful that I had that experience that changed my life. It's also that the moment that I had with my friend Gail where I realized that I wanted to have a child. And that was so startling to me because I had no interest in children and no interest in marriage. And suddenly I had that really cataclysmic revelation. And of course that is something that I have never regretted. I'm now a grandmother. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, I have friends who, because we were the first generation of women with birth control, we were the first generation of women who had a choice mm-hmm. of when we would have our children. And so some of my friends put it off, feeling that, you know, they now had the freedom to establish themselves in their careers. And by the time they got around to saying, okay, I'd like to have children now, it was too late. Many of them, they couldn't have children. And so I'm very glad that I just blindly said, yes, I want to do this. And, you know, and very soon after I got back, I did. And that is something, despite the difficulties, I was a single mother for many years, and those are not years that I would happily go back to. But it does make me feel connected to the planet and, you know, to the future through these small boys I get to watch grow up. So I'm very grateful for that. And I'm grateful that L'Arche helped me understand love in a new way. And so I found love, even though the marriage didn't last, and I do regret that, but he and I are still very good friends. And I'm here, you know, I've written these books. I love my writing. I love my teaching. I'm grateful to be right where I am.
I was going to end the conversation there, but you said something a moment ago that I just want to go back to. You say that in those early years you were insecure as an actress.
Yes.
I think it was Bill Millard in the book tells you that you're too intelligent an actress. Some would see a contradiction there. Is there?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. There is. Because because that it requires great intelligence to be an actress. That was wrong. That wasn't Bill. That was a director I met in Montreal.
Okay.
Bill said something else. There was another criticism that he had. But, yeah, what I think he meant was that I was too analytical to be an actress and that I was always, I thought too much. Mm. And there's a great deal of instinct that goes into acting, and you go with your gut, and you try different things, and there's a kind of courage, and of course there's a great intelligence in the great actors. So it wasn't that, it was that I was, first of all, I was insecure as a person, and therefore as an actress, but also that I was analytical, and I was trying to figure things out, you know, intellectually. And if I'd been able to trust my gut, to go with my gut feelings about the characters and about the circumstances of the play,
yeah,
I think I would have been a better actress.
The other thing that I was wondering, because it's a entertaining book, you know, often as I'm reading it, does writing come easily for you?
Yes. Writing comes easily, though good writing isn't so easy. So, you know, I have a blog, which I write three or four times a week, and that is really a continuation of my diary. So I've had a diary since I was 9 years old, and so it's just automatic to me to translate what's happening to paper or to the screen. And so the blog comes very easily to me. And so often a first draft comes easily. I just, you know, but then to go back and to figure out, okay, what am I really saying here? Where am I really going? What is this really about? That is as hard, that's hard work. And, you know, this book, I started it in 2014 after thinking about it for a long time, and it didn't come out till 2020. So really, it took, you know, it took me a number of years of many drafts and working with editors to say, no, you're starting in the wrong place. The focus is not correct. We need much more here and much less there. So all of that is as hard for me as for any writer, the rewriting, the figuring out, the honing down, you know, the fact that in the last drafts you're taking out everything that doesn't belong. Mm. So, I find many books these days aren't edited, that there's, you know, that editing is becoming this dying trade.
Yeah.
And a good editor helping you to figure out what this mess that you have on the page is just an invaluable assistance. I work as an editor for other writers, but I can't see myself,
right,
my own work. So writing is easy, but rewriting and getting it right is hard.
Well, let's hope that the book on your parents doesn't take 6 years, because I can't wait to read it. I mean,
Thank you so much. Oh, it's just been a great, great pleasure to talk to you, Joseph.
It has been for me. As I told you before we started, I enjoyed the book a great deal, and I've kept you longer than I said I would. But congratulations on this book, and continued good luck with it. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you very much. It was great to talk to you. Take care.
The book is called Loose Woman, My Odyssey from Lost to Found. It is published by Iguana Books. Beth Kaplan joined me on the line from Toronto. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.